It's Saturday, April 5th, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today you'll hear a conversation with children's author Elizabeth Blumley. Elizabeth Blumley was born in Arizona and has since lived in Los Angeles, Berkeley, San Francisco, Oakland, and New York City. She's been an assistant to a television writer and producer, the editor of a small press, a creative director for a book packaging company, a production manager for a literacy press, a volunteer literacy tutor, an elementary school teacher, and a school librarian. Elizabeth has a master's in education from Bank Street in New York City and a master's in creative writing from Vermont College. She has lived in Vermont since 1996 when she opened the Flying Pig Bookstore with co-owner and stand-up comedian Josie Levitt. In 2002, Elizabeth co-founded the Community Wordplay Project, a nonprofit effort to get books into the hands of qualifying Vermont families, with friend and Vermont artist Sumru Taken. Together they created the Charlottetown Players, a community theater whose proceeds fund the Wordplay Project, and the Charlotte Bookshelf, a program that gives bookstore vouchers to families who use the Charlotte Food Shelf. Elizabeth is also the author of My Father the Dog, illustrated by Cecil, published by Candlewick Press, with another book, Dogs on the Bed, illustrated by Swiss artist Anne Wilsdorf, again published by Candlewick, coming out in the fall of 2008. A third book, How Do You Waka Waka, is slated for 2009. I spoke to Elizabeth in February. Because she writes children's books, I began by asking Elizabeth what she wanted to grow up to be when she was a little girl.
Well, I wanted to be a lawyer. My father was an attorney, and I liked words, and I liked his office and the rubber stamps. So that was what appealed to me about that as a child. And then I wanted to be a professional reader, but I quickly figured out that no one would pay me to do that. So I wanted to be a writer fairly early on. I always loved wordplay, and I just inhaled books from the time I was tiny.
How old were you when you wrote your first book?
I have a tape recording of me reading an early effort. It was pretty bad, but I was 6 or 7, I think.
When did the idea for My Father the Dog strike you?
I was going to sleep, and my dog was scratching his side, and I had this flash of an image of my dad in his PJs scratching his side like my dog, Theo. And I just sat up in bed and grabbed a piece of paper and wrote the first several lines of that book. And then I put it away and I didn't think about it for several months until I was scrambling for a packet of work to send to my master's thesis advisor. And I was short on my page quantity for the month, so I remembered that story and I pulled it out to work on.
I want to talk about your master's, but I think this is a good time for you to read from
the book.
The book, if that's,
sure.
That's okay. So this is Elizabeth Blumley reading from My Father the Dog, published by Candlewick Press.
It's got these wonderful illustrations by a Texan artist named Randy Cecil, who's also illustrating my third book. It was nice to work with him again. There's a little girl in a hallway, and she's saying, "My father pretends to be human, but I know he is really a dog. Consider the evidence." When he wakes up, he's fuzzy around the edges. He starts off the day with a good scratch. He fetches the newspaper every morning. My father loves to roughhouse and play tug of war. He hates to lose. In the car, he likes the windows down and a breeze on his face. He has been known to use a tree for a quick pit stop. My father can lie around for hours. He growls when you startle him out of a nap. If you throw a ball, he'll chase after it. My father loves snacks. I've never actually seen him begging for scraps under the kitchen table, but it could happen. When he toots, he looks around the room like someone else did it. He is good at looking innocent when he knows he's done something wrong. If he hears a noise in the middle of the night, he runs downstairs to investigate. My father is loyal and thinks we're the best family in the world. Which is good, because Mom says we can keep him.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
It's fun to watch you read it, because you're smiling and enjoying it while you're reading it.
I love the pictures. I think Randy captured the warmth and affection of this little girl for her father, and he has done this hilarious thing where he makes the dad and the dog mirror one another's posture and actions. It's very, very funny.
Now, I was going to ask you, did you and Randy work together on every aspect of the book, or were the concepts for the pictures all his and the words all yours, or did you kind of...
I wrote the manuscript first and sent it to Candlewick, and the publishers generally like to hook up the author with the artist. They don't really want you to come in with your own artist in case they disagree with the vision for the book. It can work that way, but especially if you're a first-time author, you'll almost never get that kind of consideration. But I did. Candlewick is wonderful because they give their authors approval rights for the artist. So they'll suggest authors to the artist to me, and I'll suggest artists to them on my wish list. And we talk it over, and then we decide, okay, let's see if Randy will be interested, because I love his style. Then they propose to the artist. They give him the manuscript to look at. And then when he says yes, what happens is he develops a round of sketches for Candlewick. And he works with an art designer, and I work with my editor. And the editor and art designer talk, but Randy and I don't talk directly. So I get to see all the rounds of sketches and make comments to my editor, and she sort of filters what she agrees with to share with the art designer, who then puts that all together with what she thinks and gives it to Randy.
That must be so much fun when you first get to see them.
It's really fun.
Yeah,
I can't imagine. One of the reasons I approached Candlewick with the manuscript first was I couldn't imagine letting this text go and not seeing anything until the book was finished. So that happens to in a lot of publishing houses.
Oh, it does.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Is the craft of children's book writing such that a word economy is just incredibly vital? I mean, do you obsess over getting every single word exactly right?
Oh, you would be surprised. I can't remember how many words. I think there are 150 words or something in this book, and they've been through so many tweaks and revisions, and I still see things I think, ooh, you know, I could have used this word. I think poets make very good picture book writers because of that economy. And often novelists are novelists and have a hard time with picture books, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. There are some wonderful people who can do both genres, but it's a very different skill.
Can you talk a little bit about the process of getting a children's book published?
Yes. Well, the most important thing is to know what's already out there. So to go to a library, or actually, you want to spend some time in a bookstore so you see what's coming out now, what's being published this year by different houses, and you can get a feel for what the different publishing houses like to publish. And you'll get a sense of, where does my story fit? Where would it complement a list? Is it a Harcourt kind of book? Is it a Scholastic kind of book? And you really get a sense of that the more you read. And then there are some organizations that are specifically set up to help new writers. The SCBWI is the Society for Children's Book Writers and Illustrators. And they have an incredible website, and for a very small membership fee, you get an enormous amount of information. And then I guess I would say, in addition to reading, people really need to get their manuscripts critiqued and worked on. Almost no one has a perfect manuscript the first time out, and I found sometimes that new writers are eager to rush into the getting published part of things when they really need to work on polishing the skills first.
Now, you've sort of addressed this next question, but I was wondering if inexperienced children's book authors should try to bring their conception for a book to to the publisher with some sort of sketch, or if they should just leave that off altogether?
That's a common misperception. I think authors worry that they're supposed to come with art, and so they'll draft a neighbor's daughter, you know, into doing, who's a good artist, into doing some sketches, but it's the opposite. They just want to see the plain text on the paper, because they're experts at hooking you up. Also, publishers like to match a new author with a more established artist, so that someone with name recognition is kind of on that ticket.
Okay. So now, what are you working on now?
I just wrote a manuscript, just finished one, called It's Messy to Be Me. And
so that would be number four.
That would be number four that's contracted. I have other books that are out and about with different publishing houses. So we'll knock wood, we'll see what happens with those. But I did send it to my Candlewick editor, and we'll see what she thinks.
Okay, great. So It's Messy to Be Me.
It's Messy to Be Me.
And who's the narrator of It's Messy to Be Me?
A toddler who is reveling in the joys of being messy.
Oh.
And addressing the parent. It's actually, I have to say, it was really fun to write. But one thing I wanted to say when you were asking about new writers and what new writers should know, I think the most successful picture books come from the author's own sense of being a child and playfulness. And the least successful manuscripts the publishers see tend to be the ones written to some child from an adult point of view. Mm-hmm. You know, there are a lot of people out there who want to tell a story to their grandchild, and so they'll write a manuscript that their grandchildren love, and of course they love it because their grandparent has written this for them, and it's very special. But you've got to be in touch with that inner playful person so that you're really seeing the world through a child's eyes, because that's what children also will connect to in a book.
Is there any style of book that you would like to try but haven't yet?
I have about three novels in progress, and I seem to get half to two-thirds of the way through, and then really about halfway through, and I get stuck in the miry middle. So I would love to finish a novel.
Are those novels for adults? Or?
One is for adults, two are for kids, and one's for teenagers and one's for younger kids, about ages 8 to 12. And I love writing them, but I have a hard time with that longer form. I think I like the economy of a picture book because I can see the whole piece in one bite, and it's harder with a novel.
You have an MFA, a Master's in Fine Arts in Children's Writing from Vermont College, and I was curious, now that you've finished the degree, how do you feel about MFA programs?
This MFA program is... it's the best program. Everyone I went to school with will agree it's life-changing, because they don't focus, unlike many conferences, they don't focus on getting published. There are plenty of resources for getting your foot in the door. This is really about craft. And so you've got faculty members who are masters of their craft imparting this, their tips, their techniques, and their explorations with the student body. And the student body, many of them are published authors who are coming to, you know, hone their skills or try a new genre. And it's an incredible group of people. And the lectures are so exciting. It's just, it operates at a very high level of respect for the craft of children's writing.
What was your favorite book when you were a child?
As a young child, I loved Where the Wild Things Are, and I loved Blueberries for Sal. I also, when I got a little bit older, I found myself rereading. I loved E. Nesbitt, who wrote The Enchanted Castle, and a lot of these British adventure, children adventure books. I loved Edward Eger's Half Magic and Magic or Not. And Julie Andrews wrote two wonderful books. She's one of the few celebrities who's really good at it. She wrote The Last of the Really Great Wang Noodles and Mandy. And I reread those books more times than I care to admit. And Eleanor Estes and Elizabeth Enright. I call them all the E authors.
Well, and then you've left off Enid Blyton. Did you read Enid Blyton?
I never read Enid Blyton. No. she was a British author whose books I don't think were available to me here. Did you read her?
I did. Uh-huh. I loved her. And she wrote mysteries. She had a series of mysteries about these five. It was actually four kids and a dog. Five on a treasure island, five on a, I don't know, mystery train. I forget them. But.
I heard of those as an adult, and I was sad I never read them as a kid.
You still can.
Yeah, that's true.
And now I'm going to talk about me again. When I was little, we had a book, the Tall Book of Make-Believe. And some of the stories in it were absolutely terrifying. And it had this one story called Bad Mousy that it would make my mother read to me every night. That book actually is incredibly hard to get now. And it's like hundreds of dollars if you find an old used version. But anyway, apart from that, why do you think children are so fascinated by scary stories? You mentioned, you know, the wild things. You know, why?
Why? Because I think children are so powerless and vulnerable. And I think it gives them a way, those stories give them a way to face those fears. And I do think we get haunted by those books. They scare us, and yet we can't resist them. We have to face those fears. And there was a child development writer who talked about the importance of fairy tales and folk tales to children because of that, that it really was important to their developing brains to be able to address those fears in metaphorical ways that are very concrete to children in those stories.
Now, that's interesting, because a lot of the old fairy tales have been rewritten to be friendly fairy tales.
I think that makes the adults happy. I think we're more tender-skinned in some ways.
Yeah, huh. We want to protect them. I want to change our conversation a little bit and talk about your work in the bookstore. What are some of your favorite aspects of running a bookstore?
Well, my all-time favorite thing is sharing books with kids and giving them a book that you know they're going to love. And when kids come in and they're hugging a book and their eyes are lit up, I mean, it's the best thing, because books give kids a window into other lives that they otherwise would never have. It's a way to experience someone else's world. And it's a way to celebrate imagination. And kids who get involved in books are just the joy of that. There's almost nothing like it, I think, for a child, the joy you can get from a book.
So it wouldn't be fair if I didn't ask the flip side to that question. What's not so much fun necessarily about running a bookstore?
Well, the details. Every day, every job has its tedium and its details. I think a lot of people think of running a bookstore as getting to sit and read books all day. All the booksellers I know, we just laugh at that because it would be delightful if we could do it. But no one has ever sat and read a book at a bookstore, I don't think, and unless there was a snowstorm that kept everybody away. But it's the details. And if you drop the ball on something, and or something's happened to interrupt someone's special order or delay it, that's frustrating.
Yeah. How do you as an author and you as a bookstore owner feel about the increase in book chains and online, large online retailers? I'm wondering if you have any conflict inside, given your two roles, about the future of book selling.
Well, it's tough because independent bookstores are important for, it's not just that they're small stores and we should support them. So they provide some really important things that are lost when the corporate culture takes over the promulgation of ideas. I mean, bookstores are places for freedom of speech, and they're places where ideas are shared. And so if you have fewer and fewer corporate buyers making decisions about what they will and won't carry in their stores, that has political ramifications. It has censorship possibilities. There are a lot of reasons why you really want regional bookstores, community bookstores to survive. And part of it is that community sense that bookstores are often the heart of a community where people gather together of all ages and backgrounds, and you don't get that online. You know, you don't get that. And so, you know, a good chain store can offer some of those things, but ultimately their revenues are going back into the corporate headquarters and not going back into the community. They did a study about the dollars that go back into a community of an independent bookstore versus chain store. And I don't have that number in front of me, but it's quite a significant difference.
And as a writer, you know, the idea that people can get your books, you know, with the click of a button, does that give you any conflict, you know?
Well, I mean, you know, yes, but there are all these online independent bookstores, too, that that can be, you know, sell the book at a click of a button. But, of course, as a writer, I'm excited that, you know, that my book is carried everywhere. I love that my book's available. And it was funny, when it first came out, some of my friends and family members would ask me, you know, can you get that anywhere or just at your store? I think they didn't think that a real person they knew would write a real book that could be available everywhere.
And this is why you had the store in the first place, right?
That came about 10 years before that. But it was pretty funny to me that anyway, they didn't think you could get it just anywhere.
I want to mention that I saw that The Flying Pig has been nominated for the Women's National Book Association Pennell Award. So what's the criteria for winning that?
They single out one general bookstore and one children's specialty store every year who excel at connecting children with literature. And so they're looking at bookstores that have, you know, innovative creative programming and are very good at connecting kids with books.
Well, that's exciting.
It's very exciting.
Yeah, good luck. Although it's already, you know, it's already kind of a prize to have been nominated, right?
Yeah.
What are some of the books that you are frequently recommending to customers now?
Children's or adults?
Well, let's start with children's.
There's a really fun book that was published last year that kids love, and it flew a little bit under the radar. It's called The Mysterious Benedict Society. And it's just a solid, fun adventure mystery about four kids, unlikely allies, who get drawn into a mysterious society. Mm. And they're not even sure why at the beginning.
So the age range for that book would be?
That age range is about 9 to 13. Uh-huh. Okay. And that's a lot of fun.
Great. How about one for little children?
For little children, there's so many.
I know.
For little children, there's a cute book, Not a Stick, which is a sequel to Not a Box. And it has a little bit of Harold and the Purple Crayon about it. Very simple text, but very funny. And there's a book we love that's been out for a little while called Orange Pear Apple Bear. That just takes those four words and plays with them again and again in really creative combinations.
Okay.
Very clever.
What about one for adults?
For adults, I have to say Eat, Pray, Love continues. I think everyone in the universe has read this book, but it continues to fly out at the store. And Free Food for Millionaires is a wonderful novel that's starting to get, it's gotten critical acclaim, and I think it's finally catching up to the popular vote.
I have one last question for you. Do you have any favorite writing exercise that helps you when you're stuck?
There are two that I love. One sounds improbable, but it's great at getting your brain unstuck. It's a challenge to yourself to write a paragraph or two using words of only four letters or fewer. And then you come up with a theme. So you might say, you know, a girl discovers a bottle in the park. Well, you can't use the word bottle because it's got too many letters. And the way your mind comes up with different pathways to get to the descriptions of these images and the events that unfold is very exciting. It was a surprisingly great exercise for me. And then the other one takes a little bit longer, but it's to have your characters, if you're writing a novel, have your characters play the game Two Truths and a Lie with one another, where they make up two true things about themselves and one lie. And the fascinating thing about that exercise is that it lets you figure out what would they, if they were playing this game in real life, what would they want to present about themselves as the two truths, and what lie would they tell?
So do you write a scene where they're talking to each other?
I write a list of the two truths and a lie, and then I wrote a second list of the secret truths and a lie that they didn't tell each other.
Mm-hmm.
So you're getting, it gives you a layered sense of your character, of what's hidden, what are their secrets, what do they want people to know about them, how do they want to present themselves to the world, and what's really going on underneath.
That's a great, it's interesting. I think that's a really good one, particularly because a lot of times when we're stuck, it's got to do with the characters and understanding their motivations.
And deepening them, making them very real to yourself.
Right.
Yeah.
Anyway, well, thank you very much.
Thank you. This has been fun.
Yeah.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Elizabeth Blumley. Next week, at this same time, tune in again to hear an interview with author and essayist Annie Downey. Here's the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. Today at 11 a.m., children's author Kate Messner reads from and discusses her book, Spitfire, A North Country Adventure, at the Flying Pig Bookstore in Shelburne. Tonight at 7 p.m. at Phoenix Books in Essex, former three-term Vermont governor and ambassador to Switzerland, Madeleine May Cunin, reads from her new book, Pearls, Politics, and Power, How Women Can Win and Lead. Historian and author Howard Coffin discusses Civil War home sites in Vermont on Sunday, April 6th at 7 p.m. at the St. Alphonsus Parish Hall in Pittsford. He will also give this same talk on Friday, April 11th at 7 p.m. at the Pittsfield Town Hall. On April 6th, that was in Pittsford, and on April 11th, Pittsfield. Director Claudio Medeiros leads a discussion about the upcoming production of Lysistrata on Monday, April 7th at 12:30 p.m. at Middlebury College's Sealer Studio Theater. Children's books and science activities will be the focus of a parent and child science story time at the Montshire Museum in Norwich at 10:15 a.m. and 11:30 a.m. on Monday, April 7th. The monthly playwriting workshop of the Vermont Playwrights Circle will be held at the Institute for Professional Practice in Berlin on Tuesday, April 8th at 7:30 p.m. Storyteller Chris Abert discusses poetry as a performance art on Wednesday, April 9th at noon at the South Burlington Community Library as part of the library's Brown Bag Lunch Series. As part of the Why I Love What I Love series, Tom Slayton, editor of Vermont Life magazine, will speak about his new book, Searching for Thoreau, at the Kellogg Hubbard Library in Montpelier on Wednesday, April 9th at 7 p.m. Also on Wednesday, April 9th at 7 p.m., the South Burlington Community Library holds its annual poetry slam. Tony Magistrale, UVM professor and poet, will moderate. On Thursday, April 10th at 10:30 a.m., a book discussion of The Bookman's Promise by John Dunning will take place at the South Burlington Senior Center. This event is open to readers of all ages. On Thursday, April 10th at 7 p.m., local poet Daniel Lusk will read from a selection of his work at Phoenix Books in Essex. Major Jackson will be at the Flying Pig Bookstore in Shelburne on Thursday, April 10th at 7 p.m. to discuss his poetry collection, Hoops. Organic farmer Will Allen, author of The War on Bugs, will be at the Inn at Baldwin Creek in Bristol for table talk and dinner on Friday, April 11th at 6:30 p.m. If you know of an event that might be of interest to writers and readers, email it to me at writethebook@gmail.com by the Wednesday before the show. Time allowing, I'll include it in the Bookworm's calendar.
Look back through life, I find lots of memories remain.
This has been Write the Book.
Days stay
I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, in Burlington, Vermont.
I remember the Wall Street crash, or when Winchell first shouted, flash. But there's one day that I recall, though it was years ago. All my life I will remember it, I know. I'll never forget the day I read a book. It was contagious, 70 pages. There were pictures here and there, so it wasn't hard to bear. The day I read a book, it's a shame I don't recall the name of the book. It wasn't a history, I know, because it had no plot. It wasn't a mystery, because nobody there got shot.